is Twyla Paris. I'm keeping my eyes on you. It's 12 minutes. I almost said it was noon. Number 12 popped in. It's not noon. It's 12 minutes past the hour, which happens to be 8 o'clock in our central time zone. We're joined by Dr. Don Clark. Don is a member of the board at Creation Moments and a biochemist in his own right and a vintner in his other own right. He's raising.
Or my own left.
Maybe on the left he's raising. Yeah. Which would be liberal grapes. He'd be raising them liberally. And he makes wine from them here. Do you have stomping parties down there at Garden Valley? And you get all your neighbors over? I mean, you know, they help. They would raise barns together, and they would have, you know, they would slaughter hogs together. I wonder if they stomp wine together. Does that happen down there?
Well, it happens, but it's not for actually making grapes. It's just for a fun afternoon or fun day.
Well, it's a social thing.
You'd like to keep the juice a little cleaner than stomping.
Yeah, it's always impressed me as kind of a rude way to do it.
Yeah. Well, it. I guess you would definitely get them squeezed that way. Mm-hmm. Crushed.
Yeah.
But we have machines to do that now.
Okay. I think even in biblical times they had a wine press, didn't they? It was like a huge stone that would. I don't think they just walked through those wine vats. Yeah. They would. I wonder how they were made out of stone.
Right. Yeah. They and it's probably similar to how they got olive oil, except that you maybe wouldn't put quite as heavy a stone on it, I would imagine. But a pedestal, let's say, with a trough, in it, and you put a bigger circular stone disc on top of that, and whatever you're trying to crush, or that would probably do it. And of course, obviously, you would turn it, as you are turning it, it would produce the juice or the
would run off into a container somehow. That would be. I'd love to see. I think there are still some old wine presses, and maybe olive presses as well over in the Middle East. Some ancient ones to look at.
We saw them actually in Capernaum when we visited Israel.
Okay,
and there's kind of a area where they show you Peter's house, and then there's a garden, kind of a garden area, and they have at least one or two of those presses.
You know what would be an interesting project for you and Valle de, how do you pronounce the winery?
Valle della Pace.
Oh, it's Italian. I was trying to make French out of it. That doesn't work. Okay. But if you could do a little research and maybe discovered the grape that was used in the first century there to make a red wine and recreate that wine to the best of your ability. Take a little head scratching, a little work, little time, little library time probably, or internet time. And I wonder if you could do that. If that grape still exists.
That vine probably is still around somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's still around in the Middle East.
And maybe it's still being marketed, but I've not heard of it. But what if you could definitively say this was just like the wine that they ran out of at that wedding in Cana?
Yeah, that would be neat.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Wouldn't that be very, very nice?
Mm. Okay, well, a little scientific research.
Of course, the one of the problems is the yeast that we use today is specially cultured to get to ferment the dryness.
So you couldn't use that yeast then. You'd have that would be another element in the recipe. You would have to take whatever yeast occurs naturally in the air, and you'd probably have to set some. How do you do that? You'd probably have to go there to capture something close to that yeast, unless. I don't imagine you could still figure out what that yeast was and then identify it again in another location. That would be pretty tricky.
Probably.
You'd have to have the DNA. Does yeast have DNA?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Everything has DNA.
Okay, mm-hmm. You just need to get a sample. You just need to get a sample of the yeast that is.
And just do thousands and thousands of tests on the wild yeast until you came up with the right one.
You'd have to form a corporation and find some startup funds to do this and build an edifice down there in Garden Valley.
Piece of cake.
No problem.
Never mind. Let's scrap that whole idea. It's too much work. Instead, let's talk about living fossils. Dr. Don, we talk about science and faith and creation and evolution and all that kind of thing. And this is really at the heart of that whole issue, because it points up where evolutionists, and I hate to generalize because there's all colors of evolutionists out there, but this is a kind of a common error. And we're looking at an article from the Institute for Creation Research, which I will link to. And in fact, I'll do that in just a second here. I'll put a link to this article in the chat window on our Broken Road site, so you can follow along with it. But it makes mention of the fact that evidently scientists themselves can have strong emotional attachments to their worldviews. The evolutionary worldview may capture one's mind, in which case obvious questions can go unasked. Like, how did this fish, and they're referring to the coelacanth, remain unchanged for hundreds of millions of years while other fish were allegedly changing to different kinds all around it? I think that's a good question, Don.
Oh, well, you know, how did the fish didn't, why did that particular fish, not change over the millions of years? And supposedly it had gone extinct back when the dinosaurs went extinct in 65 million years ago. So not only is the fish unchanged, but the fish, lives today. Mm-hmm. And they found the coelacanth in 1938. At least it was identified as a as a living fossil, if you will, off the coast of South Africa. Mm-hmm. I guess it was a curator or an employee London Museum. Mm-hmm. Asked the local folks, who said, look, if you come up with anything unusual, let me see it. And so they called her one day, and lo and behold, here's this fish with five fins and everything. Looks very strange to us, but it was a completely alive, it wasn't alive at that time, but I mean, they had caught it, or it had washed up on the shore.
They had it stuffed.
Turned out, it turned out to be a coelacanth. So, which was at one point in time thought to be one of the ancient ancestors of one of the fish that walked out of the water and turned into, an animal, a land animal. So this was indeed a surprise that it would not only not have evolved during that time, but was still living. So this causes a major problem. It's like, well, evolution stopped, for this fish.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we explain this? Well, the obvious explanation is that, you've got two explanations. Darwin suggested one because of the horseshoe crab. The horseshoe crab is also considered to be a living, a living fossil. And he suggested that, you can have organisms that survive because they haven't been exposed to stress. So their environment is perfect for them, and they haven't been exposed to stress, so therefore they didn't evolve.
Hmm.
That was one explanation, and he was actually the one who coined the term living fossil. There was another fellow, Barris, who also gave an explanation and says, somehow they evolved to a point where they were perfect. And so they stopped evolving because, nature had reached a perfection with that particular species.
Well, they just cling to that notion that evolution had to have happened.
Yeah, exactly.
what is the professor? Excuse me, sir.
Yeah.
Perfect according to who? Or is it to whom?
Well, no, it's obvious. It's obvious. Because it hasn't changed in all of these millions and millions of years, it's obvious that evolution has reached perfection at that point for that particular species or for that particular animal. I'm glad you understand now. It's the crystal theory of how everything started too. Instead of taking the opposite view that, DNA in every creature, whether it be sea, air, land, a plant or animal, it's designed not to change. Now, you have, of course, it's designed to give variety to a particular kind of animal or creature or tree, for example.
And man has learned to induce changes within a kind.
We can do
hybrids of this and that. Yeah. Sure.
In agriculture, it's in farming, the technique of selective breeding has been going on for, hundreds, if not thousands of years. We can select out, for example, a white sheep out of a mixture of sheep, of black sheep and spotted sheep, and select out the white one and then just breed the white ones. And now you just have white sheep or white sheep with a black face. We get different types of sheep, but you're not going to produce a dog from the sheep, for example, or a goat from the sheep. you're going to produce a sheep. You're always going to produce a sheep. Instead of studying, which the evolutionists like to do, they like to study the processes that we have today and then extrapolate back millions and millions of years and say this process has been going on for millions of years. And instead of doing that with animals or with vegetation or with, sea creatures, for example, with biology, they use a different approach and say, we've got different types of animals and different types of sea creatures, so therefore they must have evolved from this primordial soup. It really is a contradiction because it shows you that in one case, as far as geology is concerned, when they look at a riverbed and see multiple layers, or they look at a canyon and see multiple layers of dirt, for example, or different strata in the Earth's crust, they conclude that took millions of years. And why do they conclude that? Well, the process that we see today, in other words, that river running through this canyon, is eroding the canyon very, very slowly. And so in order to get a mile deep canyon, that had to take a lot of time. So using the same type of reasoning, if you will, if we see an animal that is not changing today, and we see examples of hundreds, thousands, pretty much everything that we look at isn't changing today, and you extrapolate that back, you would say, well, none of this changed, and we got a little bit of variation within a kind, but we're not seeing the change, and so therefore, things have been always this way. So they use two different types of reasoning, depending on whether you're talking about geology and other things, or depending on if you're talking about biology. Matter of fact, they use the geology to justify long periods of time, because after all, they took their process from today and pushed it back millions and millions of years, rather than saying, well, maybe sometime in the past there was a catastrophe, a global catastrophe, and I wonder if we've got any written records of that global catastrophe. in man's history. And lo and behold, if they asked that question and they were honest with themselves, they would find that there are over 200 descriptions of the global flood in different cultures around the world. Now, they all, as we've talked about in this program before, they all aren't exactly similar, but it does talk about a group of people that got on something, a boat of some sort, and was saved from this global catastrophe. So, if there was a global catastrophe, and if man recorded the global catastrophe, which he would have recorded it, then we need to take the global catastrophe into account when we look at geology, but yet we don't. And at the same time, you've got in biology, for example, this notion that evolution absolutely had to exist because obviously we exist today, and things must have evolved from nothing. Yeah, rather,
it is an assumption, not a finding of fact, in my view. Well,
it is absolutely an assumption, and it's a mind thought. I mean, it's a product of the imagination, putting it another way, it's a product of the spirit world, because somebody's telling man that this is the way it was.
Interesting paragraph in this article talking about Darwin's contribution to this whole notion of living fossils, and it says that, I'll just read it to you. Darwin made up living fossils to explain the anomaly of creatures that had not evolved even over supposed eons of time. Taking that assumption as fact, it says an assumption, he claimed that living fossils also help us to visualize primeval organisms, and this is a quote from Darwin now, species and groups of species which are called aberrant, that is, showing little evolutionary change, there's another assumption, and which may fancifully be called living fossils, will aid us in forming a picture of the ancient forms of life. And that phrase, as they explain, went on to be multiplied in both academic writing and the popular press, and became kind of a core belief. You look at the coelacanth and you say, my, that looks primitive. But the only reason I think that is because somebody else has called it primitive. I mean, that could be a modern shape, because it's the same shape that the fish has always had, apparently.
Well, yes, and the reason why it looks that way is because it does some strange things. I mean, it can literally stand on its head, and, you know, it's got the fins to move itself around to do that. Now, that must be some advantage, for this fish, for it to do that, but it can stay perfectly still. It doesn't have to be swimming around. It's designed for the environment it's meant to live in, as well as, a lot of other animals and plants. They're designed to live in the environment that they live in.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because, when I was living in the Los Angeles area, the Orange County area, years ago, we often went to the Brea Tar Pits, which is, of course, a museum area, and they're actually asphalt pits, but just for the sake of argument, they're called the Brea Tar Pits, and of course, the tar pits trapped a lot of different animals, and so you got the saber-toothed tiger and many other different types of animals. Well, one of the animals that trapped that they got out of the tar pits was this prehistoric turkey. Now, they gave it a different name. But if you look at this thing, you would say, that's a skeleton of a turkey. But they say that this is a prehistoric, because they found it in the tar pits. When did the tar pits exist? I mean, when did they form initially? Well, obviously it was a result of the flood, and it was a byproduct of the decayed vegetation and animal oils that, got entrapped in the earth at the time of the flood. And so you would say, well, at most this thing is 4,000 years old and it hasn't changed.
Mm-hmm.
But they give it a totally different name, and you know, just call it I've forgotten what the name that they assigned to it, but it was a turkey.
Yeah, it'd be turkey one, probably.
And they do the same thing for like a maple leaf. So you got, and you'll see, you know, you've seen fossils of plant leaves, mm-hmm. and you would swear that leaf is a maple leaf because it, you know, it's got the points. It looks like a maple leaf, and it might be a little bigger than the current day maple leaf, but they would assign a different name to it and say that this is a prehistoric example of a prehistoric tree that lived millions of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
All of these examples are things that have not changed. I mean, they may have been a little bigger because the environment was better before the flood, for example, and then post-flood, but and if using Darwin's term, there'd be less stress on the environment. But you still come up with, you know, the same type of thing. So
and not just that, but there are animals continually being discovered. The article gives an example here of in 2011, evolutionary biologists studied a, quote, newly discovered eel that inhabits an undersea cave in the Pacific Ocean and has been dubbed a living fossil because of its primitive features. So you look at it and you say, oh, that's primitive. You know, that means that it probably hasn't evolved. You know, what's wrong with this picture? I mean, just quick assumptions like that. The first time they've seen it and they've identified its features, however it looks, as primitive. I wonder if primitive is defined anywhere else other than just being old. You know, what is a primitive feature? Is it elegance? Well, is it perfection? Is it what?
Yeah, no, it's just you look at it and it says, oh, okay, well, that must be primitive. Mm-hmm. There is no definition of the term primitive.
But see, apparently Darwin gave us that definition, though. You know, and that's a bit of an exaggeration, but what he said started the chain of thought in the popular press and in academic writing that, if you will, evolved into a term that we now apply to anything. We identify certain features as primitive as opposed to advanced or normal, even in animals we've never seen before. Now that is not logical.
Yeah, it's not logical, but it is a term. It's a characteristic that, you know, if we think that the creature is primitive, I guess it is.
Mm-hmm.
But they would do the same thing with human skulls, for example. If the human skull, and this is, how you get the imaginary ape to man sequence that you see, drawing that you see, in many natural history museums, but it's completely fabricated out of man's imagination. They would find skulls that had big furrowed brows, for example, and would call that primitive. Well, if man lived a long time, then your bone structure, I mean, you stop growing upward and your bone structure and your features get more pronounced. And one of the parts of your skull that grows is your brow. Mm-hmm. And so,
just look at David, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, his brow is getting bigger by the day.
Proof positive. Yeah.
Now, so, does that mean I'm evolving, or does that mean that I've already gotten about as evolved as I can get?
Oh, it's just a normal process. It has nothing to do with evolution.
Yeah. Well, no. It's a normal process of getting old. I mean, you're getting older. And, uh-huh, of course, uh-huh, you know, if even after the flood, for example, Noah lived, 900 years or so, but his sons lived 500, and then the age started dropping from there. Well, the patriarchs, after the flood, would have been old. I mean, would have been really old, and so they must have really had some furrow brows. And so if you discover one of those skulls, for example, you would say, oh, you know, this is obviously a predecessor to humans. Mm, so
because
it must
it's
be.
Primitive. What we perceive to be primitive things instead of just normal old things.
Yeah. Instead of saying this is obviously a patriarch. Mm-hmm. I mean, this guy, you know, or gal had to be pretty old. Mm-hmm. So, you know, our preconceived notions drive us when we try to draw some conclusions. And as we've seen in this article, you know, it drives, if you hold on to the concept that, well, things must have evolved because we exist today, rather than reading, you know, a history book and of our origins and getting in drawing from that and saying, okay, you know, of course, you know, things that we find today, while they may be unusual, were designed that way from the very beginning for the environment that they're living in. You know, so instead of drawing the correct conclusion, which is things were designed that way, the coelacanth was designed that way, the horseshoe crab was designed that way, it's got a specific function and it was designed that way, and with every animal or creature that we, you know, that we find on the earth, it was designed that way.
Now interestingly, and over time though, and DNA research has uncovered this, and I have to attribute this theory of devolution to you, Dr. Don, because you've proven it in my mind. But DNA has changed over the generations, but they term it a degradation, not an improvement in DNA. How do you explain that from an evolutionist point of view?
Well, it's hard to explain it because the evolutionists would say, well, we need mutations in order to have evolution.
Mm-hmm. We would be improved by our change in DNA somehow, right? We would live longer. We would do something.
Yeah, this is another fallacy, because mm-hmm. the fallacy of evolution is that through mutations you get improvements, and that is not only has not been shown in anything, mm-hmm. but it's actually just the opposite. So you get you don't get improvements. You get at best. The organism survives without any deleterious effects. Mm-hmm. But at worst, you know, you might have something that's like sickle cell anemia, where you've got a one amino acid change in your hemoglobin causes the protein to go from a spherical structure to an elongated structure based on the pH of your blood. That, to me, is not beneficial to the organism.
Mm-hmm.
But yet the evolutionists will point to that and say, of course it's beneficial to the organism. It was beneficial to man because, you know, those people lived in Africa and there was a lot of malaria in Africa. And the only people that most of the people that were surviving were those folks that had sickle cell anemia.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sickle cell anemia can kill you. So it's not... It's not like that's a benefit.
Not a great leap forward, no.
Mm. Yeah, no. And that's what we see. We see our DNA is degrading over time, and not getting any better. And so we start getting genetic diseases, for example. And there is no way that you're going to call a genetic disease an improvement.
Mm-hmm. And for those who are finding Dr. Don's theory of devolution too complicated, let me simplify it here. We did not come from monkeys, from chimpanzees, but we're headed that way.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, if you just look at the picture in the museums, in the natural history museums, of the monkey going to the ape, if you just turn it around,
yeah.
Flip it around, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Flip it.
Yeah. Then you've got to where we're headed.
I think so. Because, you know, there really are. And this kind of relates to something you spoke of a while ago, this collective recollection of a great flood event that wouldn't have been written down probably for centuries, and yet was written down and is a common story in different cultures all around the world. People remembered this and pressed it on, and passed it on orally. And we know that even from our own Bible times, not that long ago, 2,000 years ago, people had a tremendous capacity for remembering detail. and they had a love of detail, and they could recall things that you and I would, we got to go to the internet for now, because we don't remember them. But minds worked differently in that culture and in that time, because they depended so much on oral communication. They didn't have ballpoint pens. You couldn't jot yourself a note very easily, and so you remembered stuff. That suggests to us that people were sharper then, because out of necessity. You know, you hear the term necessity is the mother of invention. I kind of think that's true. You know, in their culture, in their time, they needed those skills to get along.
Well, they needed those skills, but they also, were closer to, of course, Adam and Eve.
Mm-hmm.
And you could imagine that Adam must have had perfect memory, perfect recall.
Mm-hmm.
God designed them to be very good, or perfect, as the term is, and so their physical forms weren't. Not only did they not have any DNA defects, but their brains had to be super sharp. Mm-hmm. And so we have definitely lost a lot of the ability that.
And that's the recall ability. But I think the brain, I think the information, the data is still stored there. We just can't recall it like we used to be able to. I mean, I think in our brains now is every scent, every sight, every sound, every word we've ever said or heard. I think it's all up there, because parts of it come back to you at the least expected time. Maybe a scent in the air brings back a memory. All the pieces are there. We just can't put them together as easily as apparently people used to be able to.
Well, I think that's right. And why can't we do that?
Mm-hmm.
Are we not exercising our brains? Well, I think that, yes, we're not exercising our brains like we like folks used to. I mean, even during Jesus' time, for example, the young Jewish boys were memorizing scripture. They were memorizing the Pentateuch
toddlerhood on up, yeah.
And while we do some scripture memorization, it is rare to find a child, and some families are doing this, obviously, that is memorizing all complete blocks of scripture. It's been shown that scripture memorization sharpens the mind. So why wouldn't, if we want to have sharp minds, why wouldn't we do it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, they may have had a little bit easier time of memorizing scripture than we do today. And it's, the older you get, the harder it is.
Well, and the more and more we rely now on external sources for information that we used to know. I mean, all I've got to do is say Rolf Harris, and David Googles the device that made the sound. He could remember it, although he came up with a pretty good explanation of it. But we jump to the internet right now to tell us things, remind us of things that we used to know anyway.
Well, that's right. And even
it's
even
a, with it's scripture, a crutch.
I mean, you've got scripture on your phone. Well, mm-hmm. At least I do.
Yeah.
I've got multiple translations on my phone.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you just do a word search. You say, okay, now I remember a scripture that says something like this. So where was that again?
Mm-hmm.
And you just, you put in the words, and within seconds you can find the scripture.
Mm-hmm. It's handy.
Which is, it's a tremendous help to those of us who teach the Bible.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is a help, and it is a crutch. But there was a time when your mind would have had all that information in it already. And a part of it, I think, is the time we spend doing that. I mean, I think it might be a developed ability just because you use it, and if you don't use it, you lose it, and we're not using it anymore. We're relying on all these other things. So anyway, Dr. Don, good topic this morning. You're talking about living fossils and how they've become to be seen as primitive when, in fact, they might be thoroughly modern millies, as a matter of fact, at the same time. Dr. Don Clark, go ahead.
I'm still looking for the brow that you were talking about earlier.
Look, get one of those.
Is it under my hair?
Give it a year or two there. Give it a year or two there. It will emerge.
Oh, okay. Oh, it's not showed up yet?
No. But it's on the way. Dr. Don Clark from Garden Valley, Texas, again, member of the board of CreationMoments.com. CreationMoments.com is their website. You should go there and see what it is they have to offer. And what you will discover is the science behind young earth creationism. And a very, what's the opposite of toxic? Untoxic. It's not argumentative. It's simply scientific and factual information that talks of young earth creationism. I think you find it fascinating. And if you're really open-minded about this thing, you need both sides. And here's definitely good information from the other side. Don Clark, we'll talk to you next Tuesday, okay?
Okay, sounds good.
See you, Don.
Take care, Don.